Chapter 23. Munich, Germany. Jack ducked beneath the tree boughs and walked until he reached the construction site's outer fence, then followed it until he reached the sidewalk along Grafengerstrasse, where he headed in Ephraim's direction. He could see the Audi 100 yards ahead and across the street. "Can you see me?" Jack radioed.
"No."
"Good." Halfway down the block, Jack stopped and looked around for landmarks. Almost there. He proceeded another 50 feet, stopped again to check his location, then slipped into the trees to his left and picked his way through the foliage until his outstretched hand touched the hurricane fence. His early reconnoiter had shown what looked like a gap in the fence. He donned the NVGs and powered them on. He'd found the spot. A triangular section of fencing had been cut away. The tool marks were old, and a cluster of vines had already pushed their way through the opening. Through the gap, Jack saw a pair of backhoe scoops, and beyond these, a row of construction trailers. This was the site's heavy equipment parking area and site offices. He crawled through the gap, then crept to the nearest backhoe scoop and ducked inside it. Though closed and vacant, Kultfabrik's buildings were too many to search, and the ground was too open for Jack's liking. Aside from the long north-south line of abandoned arcades, pubs, and pool halls on the site's far side, only two buildings had survived the demolition. To Jack's left, in the center of the site, a clamshell open-air amphitheater. To his right, sitting just inside the fence at the corner of Friedenstrasse and Grafengerstrasse, an L-shaped office building. The walls of the first four floors were finished, sans windows. But the fifth floor was still mostly skeletal, with iron beams and girders backlit by the night sky. Overlapping blue plastic tarps formed the building's temporary roof. Aluminum scaffolding enclosed the building's first three floors. This was his destination. If he were laying a trap, he'd want the high ground. At the very least, it was the ideal observation post. As a sniper perch, it was serviceable. Jack checked his watch. 8:45. He scanned the office building with his NVG, left to right and bottom to top. In his monochrome view, the walls appeared gray. The window openings were charcoal rectangles. He saw no shadows, no movement. He picked up a rock and hurled it over the bulldozer. As the rock thunked against the nearest trailer's roof, Jack watched the building. Again, he saw no movement. Twice more, he repeated the process with the same result, then once more, but this time pelting the side of the building itself. Nothing. Either Müller's men were not set up in there, or they were too disciplined to overtly react to Jack's stone throwing. Either way, it was time to move. Jack slipped back to the fence and turned left, using the low-hanging tree branches to cover his movement. When he reached the building, he paused to look and listen, then continued to the corner of the fence. Jack looked right. Through the foliage, he could just make out Ephraim's shadowed form sitting in the Audi's driver's seat. "I'm at your 9 o'clock." Ephraim's head turned. In the NVG glow, Ephraim's eyes narrowed and darted. "Yeah, I don't see you. Nothing to report. All quiet. Maybe we've got it wrong." A small part of Jack hoped Ephraim was right. Getting into a firefight on foreign soil was something best avoided. Trading bullets with bad guys in a major city was downright stupid. The cacophony coming from Optimalwerke would obscure the sounds of gunfire, but that was little comfort. You never fight the war you want, Jack knew. You fight the war you have. "We'll find out soon enough," Jack replied. "I'm going in." He drew his HK, stepped out from under the trees, raised the gun, and stalked forward. He was facing the hollow portion of the structure's L shape, most of which was crowded with wheelbarrows, cement mixers, and sawhorse tables. With both his gun and his eyes alternating between the windows above and the ground ahead, Jack picked his way through the maze to a broad archway he assumed would eventually be the lobby entrance. He ducked right, pressed himself against the inner wall. The sounds of Optimalwerke's revelers and pumping music faded slightly. He looked around. Though the building's exterior was nearly finished, the interior had a long way to go. The lobby was a slab of rough concrete, crisscrossed with power cables and pneumatic hoses. The interior beams were exposed along with the water pipes and electrical conduits. Half-finished ducting snaked above Jack's head. Directly ahead lay an open elevator shaft, and on either side of this, a pair of stairwells leading upward. Ephraim radioed, "Jack, I see something." Jack cupped his hand around the headset microphone. "What and where?"
"Light, just a flicker. Second floor. No, third floor, my side."
To my left and above, Jack thought. Instinctively, he pointed the NVGs that way. He answered Ephraim,
"Roger. Don't make me ask next time."
They'd gone over this. The more radio silence Jack maintained, the better his chances. Ephraim's reports needed to be concise but thorough.
"Yeah, sorry," he said. "I'm moving up to the second floor."
Ephraim replied, "Roger," with a double click. Jack headed to the left-hand stairwell and started upward. At the first landing, he stopped, leaned forward, peeked up, saw nothing, and kept going until he reached the second floor. Here there was an opening for a door, but no door. Jack stepped forward with his HK at relaxed high ready until he could see left through the opening. Ephraim called,
"A car just pulled up to the gate. Two men getting out."
"Shit.
Cars pulling away. Oh, damn."
Ephraim went silent for 10 seconds, then came back.
"It turned onto Grafingerstrasse. I don't think they saw me."
"License plate?"
"Missed it, sorry." "Okay, the guys are at the gate."
"It's not locked, Jack. They're just pulling the chain."
That tended to confirm Ephraim's report of seeing light on the third floor. Muller's men were already here, and now more were arriving. Either that, or these newcomers were construction site security guards, and someone had forgotten to padlock the gate.
"I'm looking for weapons," Ephraim whispered. "I can't tell." "Okay, they're through the gate, heading your way." "Lost sight of them."
Jack double-clicked. He took another step forward, peeked right, and saw nothing. From somewhere above came the crackle of a portable radio. Then, in German,
"Ja, dritten Etage."
"Yes, third floor." Jack heard the scuff of shoes on the stairs. He looked over the handrail and saw a pair of men trotting up the stairs. Each was carrying a compact assault weapon, a FAMAS bullpup or one of its variants. These men weren't security guards. Jack stepped through the door, then sidestepped 4 paces down the wall and raised the HK to shoulder height. He took a breath, let it out, slowed his breathing. "Let both of them get through the door first," he told himself. The footsteps reached the landing, then started up the next flight of stairs. The party's on the third floor. Jack counted to 5, then paced forward, peeked around the corner in time to see the men turning onto the next landing. Moving on flat feet, Jack stepped out and followed. He reached the landing and leaned sideways over the railing in time to see the 2 men disappearing through the doorway. He started up the stairs. He was 2 steps from the third floor landing when Ephraim's voice came over the headset.
"Jack, you there?"
Jack froze and gave the radio a double click.
"I miscounted. The light I saw was on the 4th floor. It just started moving again. I'm so sorry."
4th floor. Men above me. He spun left, brought the HK up. A darkened figure was pacing down the steps. The man saw Jack, muttered, "Scheiße," and jerked his rifle up. Jack shot him 2x in the chest, dropping him. The already limp body slid down the steps and landed in a heap at Jack's feet. The report of Jack's HK sounded like a phone book being whacked with a wooden mallet.
"Was ist das?"
a voice whispered.
"Where?"
"Behind me." He turned, saw a man stepping through the doorway, a 2nd man on his heels. Jack fired 1x, stepped forward, fired again, then charged forward and bulldozed the man backward into the 2nd man, who instinctively reached out to grab his collapsing partner. As he did so, Jack shot him in the forehead, Tangled together, the two men crumpled. One of their rifles clattered to the concrete floor. Jack turned again, checked the up and down stairway. Both were clear. He stepped through the door, looked right, then left. He checked the faces of the two downed men. Neither was Stefan Müller. He sidestepped the bodies and crouched behind a garbage can. His heart was pounding. He could taste acid in his mouth. He switched the HK to his left hand and wiped his sweaty right palm on his pant leg. Ephraim called,
"Jack, what's going on? I heard..."
Jack double-clicked. Ephraim went silent. Three men down, Jack thought. Four rounds fired, eight left. Was there anyone else upstairs? Probably at least one. Müller, maybe? Three men made little sense. Paired teams seemed more likely. If so, Jack had to assume whoever was left upstairs knew something had gone awry. Jack's HK was quiet, but not that quiet, especially to someone with a trained ear. Jack put himself in their shoes. What's the best play? Stay put, prepare an ambush, and make the attacker come to you. Force him to check every room and doorway on the fourth floor. Let the fear gnaw at him. Call for reinforcements. Jack crouch-walked to the two fallen men, quickly searched each one and came up with two wallets and two cell phones, all of which he stuffed into his jacket pockets. He picked up the nearest rifle he saw, a FAMAS F1, and slung it over his back. Next, he returned to the stairwell and frisked the other man, but found neither a wallet nor a cell phone. He was, however, carrying a pair of car keys. What's it going to be, Jack? He'd gotten some intel. How worthwhile, he didn't yet know. But if there was a chance Müller was upstairs, Jack wasn't going to let him go. Jack returned to his hiding spot behind the garbage can and keyed his headset. Ephraim.
I'm here. Are you okay?
Fine. Anything going on out there?
Nothing.
I'm moving up to the fourth floor. Keep a sharp eye out. If any more vehicles pull up, give me as much warning as possible.
Will do.
Jack crossed the floor to the opposite stairwell, posted himself beside the doorway, then did his peek check before starting up the steps. Just below the landing, he froze. Somewhere above, a crackling sound, a snap, a rustle. The wind had picked up, he realized, shifting the temporary tarpaulin roof. Jack kept climbing until he reached the fourth floor, where he again paused. Through the doorway, he could see a hallway, and beyond this, an open space in the midst of being framed into offices, conference rooms, and communal work areas. Jack scanned from left to right with his NVGs, but saw nothing. Clang! Jack turned and cocked his head, trying to pinpoint the sound's location. Ephraim called,
Jack, I've got movement again. I can barely make him out through the trees. Hold on, I'm getting out for a better look.
Don't, Jack rasped. Stay put.
I'm almost there.
Jack heard another clang and then recognized the sound. Scaffolding. Ephraim whispered,
I see him. He's outside, on the scaffolding stuff. My side, the north side. What do you want me to do?
Get back to the car and leave, Jack ordered. If Ephraim could see the man, it was safe to assume the man could see Ephraim.
Circle the block and park farther down Grafingerstrasse. I'll find you.
Okay, I'm going.
Jack stepped into the hallway and turned right, heading to the building's north side. Halfway there, he heard a faint pop, pop, pop. Gunfire. Jack started running.
Ephraim called, Shit, what was that? Jack, I've got a problem. I need help.
Jack picked up speed. He heard the clang of feet on the scaffolding, but couldn't tell from what direction. The strap to his night vision goggles slackened, and his vision began to vibrate. The images a jumbled gray mosaic of empty rooms, hallways, framing studs. He charged into an open space, looked left. A figure crouched in the nearest window, half on the scaffolding, half inside the room. A muzzle flashed orange and Jack glimpsed Müller's face. The beard was gone, but it was him. Jack dropped and slid like a baseball player while curling himself into what he hoped would be a harder target. His momentum carried him halfway across the room, where he crashed into a sawhorse. The plywood tabletop collapsed, the wooden edge dropping toward his face. He threw his hand up, turned his head, then felt something hard slam into the corner of his eye. He rolled onto his belly, looked around, and tried to get his bearings. To his right was the now empty window from which Muller had been firing. He crawled out from under the plywood and stumbled that way, gun coming up. "Ephraim, you there?" Jack called. No response. Jack reached the window. From below came a clang, followed by footsteps pounding on aluminum rungs. Jack poked his head out the window, looked left, and glimpsed a figure scrambling down the scaffolding's cross braces. Jack took aim, but the man was gone. Jack ducked back inside, hurried to the opposite window, stuck his head through. Muller was below him on the first floor scaffolding. He looked up, saw Jack, fired, then dashed away. Jack sprinted back down the length of the floor to the stairwell, where he took the steps, two at a time, until he reached the lobby. In seconds, he was outside. He looked right. Muller was gone. He went still and listened. Faintly, he heard the slow ding, ding, ding. Jack recognized it as the chime of an open car door. He keyed his radio. "Ephraim." Silence. "Ephraim, answer me." No response. Jack ran to the main gate. It was standing partially open. He ducked through and, guns still raised, trotted down the sidewalk to the corner. Across the street, the door to Ephraim's Audi was open, the interior dome light glowing in the darkness. Ephraim was gone. Chapter 24. Munich, Germany.
"Schweinhund!"
The shout came from behind Jack. He turned in time to see a crowd outside Optimalwerke's entrance envelop an SUV, and in seconds all Jack could see was its taillights through the multitude of legs. SUV. Silver or light gray, Jack thought. Maybe. He sprinted to Ephraim's Audi, got in, shut the door, and started the engine. He pulled away from the curb and sped down Friedenstrasse. Ahead, the Optimalwerke revelers were dispersing, revealing the SUV's brake lights in the distance. Jack sped up and swerved around the mob. Angry and drunken faces flashed past his window. Fists pummeled the sides of the Audi. Jack floored the accelerator, and the Audi's engine surged. Ahead, the SUV turned right onto Rosenheimerstrasse. If Ephraim wasn't in that vehicle, Jack was screwed. If the journalist was, Jack didn't have the luxury of running a covert pursuit. Once Muller or whoever was driving got Ephraim to a secure location, it was over. The only question would be whether they tortured him first or simply put a bullet in his head. If they hadn't already. Should have told Ephraim no from the start. He reached the stop sign a few seconds later, tapped the brakes and glanced left to make sure the road was clear, then spun the wheel and accelerated again. The Audi's tail swerved momentarily before the tires caught hold and it snapped back. The SUV was 50 yards ahead and appeared to be in no hurry. Jack let the Audi coast a bit, closing the gap but not enough to alarm the SUV's occupants, until finally he could make out the license plate. MODZL292. Through the back window he saw a figure rise up in the rear seat. There was a commotion. The passenger turned in his seat and started batting at the figure until it disappeared from view. Ephraim was putting up a fight. "Lie still," Jack thought. "Don't be more trouble than you're worth. Not yet, at least." Jack accelerated until his bumper was almost touching the SUV's, then started flashing his high beams. He didn't expect them to pull over, of course, but now they knew there was a witness, a thorn. If they wanted to get clear with Ephraim, they'd have to deal with Jack first. The SUV accelerated, opening a gap, but Jack countered until he was again on their tail. The SUV's brake lights flashed. Jack braked hard, swerved left, and found himself alongside the SUV. Jack didn't need to see the vehicle's window rolling down to know what was coming. He jerked the wheel, crushing the Audi against the SUV. Jack's passenger window spiderwebbed once, twice, then shattered inward. Wind gushed through the Audi's interior. He slammed on the brakes, letting the SUV pull ahead, then slid in behind it as a train overpass enveloped them. Jack stomped on the gas pedal and smacked into the SUV's bumper. He backed off and did it again, this time angling the nose of the Audi into the SUV's quarter panel in hopes of sending it into a spin. The SUV's driver countersteered into Jack, and he lost the angle. This couldn't go on for long, Jack knew. If the police weren't already on their way, they soon would be. That might solve the issue of Ephraim's rescue. But if the occupants of the SUV opened fire on the police, there might be bodies in the street, and at best, Jack would end up in jail. He needed to end this quickly. The road dipped, and the SUV slipped into an underpass with Jack a few feet off its bumper. Headlights flashed through the Audi's windshield. The blaring of car horns echoed through the tunnel. Jack weaved right, trying to pass the SUV, but again the driver countered, swerving and shoving Jack toward the guardrail, forcing him to brake hard. The SUV surged ahead, emerged from the underpass, and turned left at the next intersection. Jack momentarily lost sight of it, and then, as he too made the turn, saw the SUV fishtailing and disappearing through a gate and a long wooden fence. Jack overshot the gate, braked to a stop, then reversed and turned in. On either side of the car, massive open-sided bays stacked with lumber flashed past the Audi's windows. A lumber yard. Bright, pole-mounted security lights cast sharp circles of light on the pavement. A forklift emerged from an alley to Jack's right. He jerked the wheel left, but not enough. The forklift's blades scraped down the Audi's side and shattered the rear window. Jack slammed on the brakes, glanced at the side-view mirror, and saw the forklift was still upright, its driver climbing down from the cab. He hit the accelerator again. Ahead, the SUV turned right and disappeared behind a warehouse. Jack was 5 seconds behind. The SUV was gone. To his right was the warehouse wall. The nearest door, lit from above by a spotlight, was 50 yards away and partially closed. Too far. Jack looked left down an alley bordered by tiered stacks of railroad ties. No sign of the SUV. He kept going, glancing down the next alley as he went past. At the third intersection, he saw the SUV's tail end disappear behind a lumber stack. It was running parallel to him, its lights off. Jack jammed the accelerator against the floorboards, pushing the Audi's accelerator past 50, then tapped hard on the brakes and spun the wheel left, slewing the car down the next alley. He let the tail end snap back, then accelerated again and reached the next intersection just as the SUV sped past. Jack didn't slow, but raced to the next intersection, did a handbrake skid turn to the right. As he raced through an exit gate, the pavement turned to rutted dirt. Out his passenger window was a line of trees, and through these he could see fragmented light that seemed to be moving, keeping pace with him. A train, he realized. He sensed movement out his passenger window, glanced that way. The SUV's headlights filled the Audi's interior, blinding him. He jammed on the brakes. Through the windshield, he saw the SUV fishtail and its rear bumper clip the Audi's hood. Jack steered into it, but overshot. A pyramid of railroad ties loomed through the windshield. He countersteered, but not quickly enough. Too late. The Audi sideswiped the stack, and a pair of ties crashed into the hood and spiderwebbed the right half of the windshield before tumbling over the roof and disappearing. Jack spun the wheel, bringing the Audi back in behind the SUV. Time to end this, he thought. Hold on, Ephraim. He eased left and accelerated. The SUV took the bait and moved to cut him off. Jack tapped the brakes, swerved right and down the SUV's opposite side, then jerked the wheel hard, ramming the Audi's bumper into the SUV's tire. The driver had no choice but to counter, but he overdid it. The SUV's rear tires, now sideways to the vehicle's momentum, stuttered over the furrowed ground. The SUV flipped onto its side, then began spinning toward the trees. Dirt and chunks of the vehicle's chassis peppered Jack's windshield. He hit the brakes, and the Audi skidded to a stop. Jack got out and paused to get his bearings. Dust swirled in the beams of the Audi's headlights. The sudden halt to the chase left him momentarily dizzy. Which way? He raised the HK and started jogging toward what he guessed was the tree line. From the darkness, a lone gunshot. A round in Ephraim's head? He wondered. He slowed down, hunched over, and tried to localize the sound, then eased left. Somewhere in the distance, a train whistle echoed, then went silent. Abruptly, the dust thinned, and he found himself in the trees. A branch smacked into his forehead. He landed on his butt, got back up. To his right, one of the SUV's turn signals blinked yellow in the darkness. He headed that way.
Jack, he's out there!
Ephraim's voice. Jack froze, crouched, sidestepped behind a tree trunk. He assumed Ephraim was referring to Muller.
Just him? He called. The driver's not moving. Are you hurt? I don't know. I've got one of their guns.
Jack didn't know if this was true, but it was a smart move on Ephraim's part.
Sit tight.
Faintly, Jack heard the warble of sirens.
Police are on the way.
This was as much a problem for them as it was for Muller, but Jack hoped the German would flee before he had time to think that through. Then again, Muller was just unflappable enough to do the opposite.
No, I gotta get out, Ephraim shouted. This thing's leaking gas.
Jack could smell it now. From the direction of the railroad tracks came the clank of steel wheels. A train was coming. Jack realized his NVGs were still hanging around his neck. Using his free hand, he settled them over his eyes. The left lens was shattered, leaving him only a grayish monocular view of his surroundings. With each beat of his heart, the view vibrated. He took a calming breath, then looked around, starting behind himself and moving slowly toward the crashed SUV. He stopped. Movement. He panned back and focused on a bush. Something there, he thought, a straight line in the curved branches. Too much bulk in the foliage. He took aim on the shape and fired once. Nothing moved. A branch snapped. Jack spun right. 20 feet away, a figure was moving through the trees toward him. Jack raised the HK, laid the front sight on the figure's center of mass.
Hallo, ist da jemand?
A male voice called. Hello. Is anyone there? Jack kept the HK trained on the man. Was it Muller?
Wer ist da? Jack called. Holzlager, came the answer.
Lumberyard.
Polizei. Gas.
Luckily, the word was the same in both languages. With any luck, the man would relay this message to the first police on scene. It might slow them down a bit.
Okay, ich verstehe.
Jack waited until the man had backed out of sight, then headed for the SUV. He had no time left. If Muller was lying in wait, Jack would know soon enough. Jack picked his way through the trees to the SUV, which was lying on its left side. As he approached, Ephraim's hands rose through the moonroof and wagged. His wrists were secured by a zip tie.
Jack, is that you?
Yeah. Can you climb up?
I think so.
The odor of gas was almost overpowering now, stinging Jack's nostrils. Behind him, a train rattled past, its lighted windows flashing through the trees. Jack made his way to the SUV's windshield and peeked through. The driver lay in a heap, half against the door, half on the dashboard. His head was pointing in the wrong direction. His neck was broken. Jack photographed the SUV's VIN. Ephraim hopped to the ground beside Jack. He stumbled, then steadied himself against the car.
Whoa, dizzy.
Jack asked, no gun?
I was lying, hoping Muller would hear me.
What about your 38? We can't leave it behind.
Oh, yeah, it's in the Audi's center console.
Jack took out his penknife, sawed through the zip ties around Ephraim's wrists and pocketed them. Ephraim asked,
souvenir?
DNA. Ephraim's prints might be all over the inside of the car, but Jack wasn't about to leave behind such an obvious piece of trace evidence. We need to go. Can you run?
A close imitation, at least, Ephraim replied.
Jack had no specific plan aside from putting distance between themselves and the scene of the crash. Their best option was to head east, he decided, and try to make their way back to where Jack had parked his car, near Kultfabrik. They were a quarter mile from the crash site, following the rail line north toward the Ostbahnhof, and using the trees alongside the ballast embankment as cover. Occasionally a train would rumble past, its brakes squealing as it slowed for the station. The chase and subsequent crash had attracted a lot of attention, Jack could tell from the flashing glow of emergency lights above the trees. He saw no sign of police helicopters, but that wouldn't last long. Jack was already assembling the worst-case scenario in his head. After securing the crash site and letting the firefighters deal with the SUV's gas leak, the police had likely set up a perimeter, then begun searching the surrounding area for the vehicle's occupants. One man was dead, and gunfire had been exchanged during a high-speed chase. If the first officers on the scene believed the lumberyard worker, one of Munich's finest had inexplicably disappeared from the scene, possibly the victim of a kidnapping. Around them, the trees began to thin. Jack saw the glow of street lamps. "Wait here," he said, and kept walking until he reached the sidewalk. A police car drove past, its spotlight skimming over the trees. Jack stepped back deeper into the shadows until the car was out of sight, then returned to where Ephraim was leaning against a tree, massaging the side of his head. Jack said, "We're at Rosenheimerstrasse, not far to Kultfabrik." "Let's hail a taxi," Ephraim said. "We can't afford witnesses," Jack replied. If they hadn't already, the police would soon be contacting taxi companies, asking if anyone had done just what Ephraim was suggesting.
"My head hurts. Bastard thwacked me with a gun.
Müller?
Who else? Just because I tried to kick him in the head."
Courtesy of Stefan Müller, Ephraim's head had taken a beating, first from a bullet graze, now from a pistol whipping.
"I'm starting to not like the guy very much."
Jack couldn't help but laugh.
"Don't blame you. What now? Which way?"
Jack checked his watch. Less than 20 minutes since the chase had started. It seemed much longer than that. He wondered if the police had managed to identify Kultfabrik as the point of origin yet. He doubted it. Right now, drunken complaints from Optimalwerke people were probably low on the list of priorities for the police. It would take time to assemble the puzzle pieces. Jack took off his jacket, pulled it inside out, exposing the red lining, and handed it to Ephraim. "Put the hood up, too. You look like shit." Ephraim shrugged.
"Thanks for coming after me, by the way."
With lights flashing, another police car raced down Rosenheimerstrasse, followed closely by a matte black panel truck containing what Jack guessed was Munich PD's version of a SWAT team.
"How are we going to explain this, Jack? They'll find out the Audi's under my name."
Jack thought about it for a moment. "Go back to the hotel. The police will show up eventually. Your story is the car must have been stolen. You must have left the keys in it. Stick with that story and keep it simple. Just like you did with the Alexandria cops. Be curious, but not too curious. Ask them for a report number so you can call your insurance company and the rental car agency."
"Yeah, I get it," Ephraim said.
Jack's cell phone chimed. He dug it out of his pocket and checked the screen. It was a text from Belinda Hahn, or at least from her cell phone. She wasn't using the burner he'd given her.
"Jack, I think there are people outside."
Ephraim was looking over his shoulder.
"A trap, you think?"
Jack texted back to Belinda, "Blue." She replied with their agreed-upon confirmation code, "Little boy." Ephraim said, "Still not proof." "It's as close as we're going to get. We don't really have a choice."
"They could have gotten it out of her, or she could be involved."
Jack cut him off. "Ephraim, we're not ignoring this." Even so, the timing of Belinda's call for help wasn't lost on Jack. Müller had three loose ends, Jack, Ephraim, and Belinda Hahn, and the German had just tried to wrap up Jack and Ephraim. Why not go for all three on the same night? Jack texted her, "Where are you?" Belinda replied with an address, then asked, "What do I do?" "Lock doors, windows. Hide," he answered. "If anyone tries to force the door, call the police." "Have pepper spray?"
"Yes."
"I'm scared," Belinda texted. "I'm on my way." Chapter 25. North of Munich, Germany. Jack turned off the highway and headed north. His headlights illuminated a sign that read Marzling, 3 kilometers. According to his dashboard clock, almost an hour had passed since Belinda had first texted him.
Damn it!
He checked his phone. It had been almost 15 minutes since Belinda had responded to his last text. To his dismay, she had simply said, "Please hurry." The day before, when he'd advised her to find someplace else to stay, he should have been more specific. Someplace nearby. According to Google Earth, the address she'd texted him from belonged to what looked like a farmhouse-turned-cabin 25 miles north of Munich, just outside the village of Marzling and on the banks of the Isar River. It had taken him and Ephraim a precious 15 minutes to make their way back to Kultfabrik, and then another 15 for Jack to drop Ephraim at the hotel and reach the highway leading out of the city. Following his phone's navigation cues, Jack drove into Marzling proper, then turned south onto Isarstrasse, which took him past a mile of farm fields and homesteads to a bridge spanning the Isar. Once across this, he turned left onto a dirt road that followed the river's meandering banks. During his drive north, rain clouds had thickened and the wind had picked up, rippling the river's surface. Fat raindrops spattered against his windshield. When he was a half mile from the cabin, he reached a fork in the road. To the right was Blaue Forellestrasse, the cabin's de facto driveway. He drove 50 feet past it and pulled over. Part of him wanted to hurry, to find out why Belinda had gone silent, but he resisted the impulse. At Kultfabrik, he'd rushed his clearing of the building's third floor and had almost paid for it. If Belinda was already dead or had been taken, a headlong charge at the cabin would do nothing to change that. He texted her again. "What's happening?" After nearly a minute of silence, the phone chimed with her response. They were in the house. "Red," Jack texted. "Baron," came Belinda's reply. "Gone now?" "I think so," she replied. "How long ago?" 20-30 minutes, Belinda texted. "How many men?" asked Jack.
"Don't know. Afraid to move. Hiding in closet."
There were 2 possibilities, Jack decided, both plausible, and one perhaps the product of overthinking on his part. He'd gotten Belinda's text within 10 minutes of the crash at the lumberyard. If Muller's men had been sitting on Belinda's cabin, Muller might have ordered them to spook her in hopes that she would send out a call for help, and then to hunker down and wait for Jack's arrival. They had nothing to lose but time on a fruitless ambush. The second possibility was more straightforward. Having failed to kill Jack and Ephraim, Muller had decided to minimize his exposure and ordered his men to withdraw. As for Ephraim's suggestion that Belinda was in league with Muller, Jack's gut said no. He called up Google Earth and zoomed in on the property. Sitting as it did in the river's valley, the cabin was surrounded by trees in full bloom, fed by the Isar's spring melt. While the terrain ruled out ambush at a distance with long guns, the thickness of the foliage offered plenty of places for bad guys to hide and wait for Jack's approach. "Nothing's perfect," he reminded himself. "No plan survives first contact with the enemy." He'd deal with whatever came. Jack texted Belinda, "I'm just passing Eching. Be there ASAP." If this got passed on to Muller's men, it might give Jack an advantage. Jack spent the next 30 minutes picking his way through the forest until his legs were numb from crouching, his elbows and knees were raw from crawling, and the batteries in his off-brand NVGs were so weak it was like staring into a static-filled television. The rain clouds had so far failed to open up, but rather spit droplets that struck the ground like hurled pebbles. Jack could feel a bone-deep cold settling into his limbs. When the rear wall of the cabin finally came into view, he forced himself to lie still in the undergrowth and watch for another 5 minutes. The cabin had indeed once been a Bavarian-style three-story farmhouse, with a cedar mansard roof, whitewashed exterior, and dark green shutters. It wasn't far from what Jack's younger self would have imagined a gingerbread house to be like. Nothing was moving, and he saw no lights visible. Jack crawled ahead and wormed his way underneath the wraparound porch, then got out his phone and texted, almost there, turning onto Blaue Forelle. This was the road leading directly to the cabin. Now to see if his impending approach got a reaction. Belinda didn't respond. Another 5 minutes passed. Either he was alone, or Müller's men were too damned good for him to spot. Next, the house. Before he even reached the front door, he could smell the stink of gas. Jack holstered his gun. Its muzzle blast would be more than enough to ignite the gas. He pulled the collar of his t-shirt up over his nose and tried the doorknob. It was unlocked. He pushed through, then sidestepped left, clear of the backlit doorway. Belinda had said she was in a closet. Where, though? He texted the question to Belinda, and again he got no response. Depending on how long this gas had been flowing, she could already be dead. Led by his penlight, Jack moved through the cabin as quickly and quietly as possible, opening windows and stopping at every door that might be a closet until he'd cleared the first floor. He climbed the stairs and repeated his search. At the end of the hall in a bathroom linen closet, he found Belinda curled into a ball. Clutched loosely in her hand was a cell phone, not the burner he'd given her. He checked her pulse. She was alive. He shook her. Belinda! No response. He rubbed his knuckles hard against her sternum, and she let out a moan. Downstairs, a door slammed. Jack froze. Listened. He crept to the bathroom window and looked out. The pain beside his head exploded. He ducked, dropped to his belly, crawled back to Belinda. He grabbed her wrist and dragged her into the hallway. Think, Jack. Get shot dead or burned alive. Belinda's cell phone beeped. Jack grabbed it, checked the screen. It was a text. Come out. You come with us. She goes free. Beyond the obvious, that someone preferred him alive for the time being, this text message told Jack something. If they planned to blow the house, the ignition source was probably already in place and remotely controlled. How and where? Buy some time, Jack. He texted back. She's almost dead. Can't move her until she's awake. Come out now. She will be tended to. This was a lie, of course. When I know she's okay, I'll come out. Need fresh air. Breaking window. Don't shoot. No response. Jack crawled back into the bathroom to the window and used the butt of his HK to shatter the remaining panes. The phone beeped. No more windows. 5 minutes. Be smart. Was the cabin close enough to Martzling to be on city gas? Jack wondered. Maybe not. Propane, then. He hadn't seen a tank outside, so where was it? The most likely place was the basement. He pulled Belinda close to him, scooped her onto his shoulder, then crouch-walked back down the stairs to the kitchen. He found the basement door set into the wall behind the dining table. As quietly as he could, he slid this aside and opened the door, revealing a set of stairs leading down into darkness. The stench of propane washed over Jack, almost doubling him over. He coughed, and bile filled his mouth. He swallowed it. His vision was sparkling. Though all the windows on the first floor were open, propane tended to settle, so he was likely standing waist-deep in the gas. Go out the front, Jack. Surrender. Take your chances. Play for time. That might work for him. But not for Belinda, he knew. they would kill her regardless. The other option, to go out shooting, was also a non-starter. In Hollywood blockbusters, this desperate gambit was glorious to behold and almost always successful. But it rarely worked in the real world. He and Belinda wouldn't make it off the porch before being cut down.
Root cellar.
Unbidden, the words popped into Jack's head.
Maybe.
Another text. 3 minutes. Jack replied, "She may be dying. Not coming out until she's awake. You want me, you have to wait." "No," came the reply. "Send someone in here to help me." There was no response, which was no surprise. For all he knew, his capture was a secondary priority. If he pushed too far, they might simply blow the house. Jack laid Belinda on the kitchen counter, dug his knuckles into her sternum, then flicked her eyeballs with his fingers. She winced, then let out a groan.
"Belinda, do you hear me? Belinda, it's Jack."
"Jack," she murmured.
"Is there a root cellar?"
he asked. He wasn't going into the basement, where the propane would be the thickest, without knowing there was an escape route. Jack kept rubbing his knuckles against her chest bone.
"Belinda, root cellar. Is there a root cellar?"
Her eyelids fluttered open and focused on Jack.
"Root cellar?"
"In the basement. Is there one?" She nodded feebly.
"Behind water heater."
The phone beeped. 2 minutes, the text said. Jack didn't reply. They weren't bluffing. He threw Belinda over his shoulder, walked to the nearest window, spent 30 seconds inhaling fresh air, then clamped the penlight in his teeth and headed down the stairs, the beam dancing wildly over the walls. At the bottom was a narrow brown brick passage. Now the stench of propane was almost acidic, like a chunk of manila rope being snaked through his sinuses. Jack turned right. Belinda's head bumped against the bricks. She let out a yelp.
A good sign.
The passage opened into a 20-by-20-foot rectangular space with a dirt floor. Sitting against the left-hand wall was a long propane tank. Jack headed that way, playing his flashlight over the piping until he found a cluster of gauges. Zip-tied to one of the pipes was a pencil detonator bundled to a cell phone with duct tape. Simple and effective. The number of wraps on the duct tape made getting to the phone's battery time-consuming. More important, the accelerometer that was likely built into this phone could also serve as an ideal anti-tamper switch.
"Forget it. Move on."
Belinda's body, draped limply over his shoulder, started convulsing. She retched. Jack felt the gush of warm vomit on his neck. He turned his head, shining the beam over the space. Ahead, sitting beside a line of wall-mounted wooden shelves, was the cylindrical water heater. Jack headed that way. Nausea washed over him, and his stomach heaved. He kept putting one foot in front of the other. The cell phone beeped again. He didn't need to look at it. 1 minute warning. He reached the water heater and followed its curve to the rear wall. His knee bumped against something hard, but not brick. Wood. He looked down, and his flashlight illuminated a waist-high hatch. He dropped to his knees, grabbed the handle, and jerked. The hatch swung open. He bent at the waist and let Belinda slip off his shoulders, then wriggled past her into the tunnel. He reached back, grabbed her wrist, dragged her toward him. On hands and knees, he repeated the process until the tunnel opened into an alcove. Set into its opposite wall were four wooden steps that ended at a set of angled swinging doors. Down their center, Jack could see a slice of faint light. He crawled up the steps, put his back against the doors, and pressed until he was certain they weren't locked. He crawled back to Belinda, dragged her up the steps, her head thumping against each of them in turn. Jack removed the penlight from his mouth and clicked it off, then drew the HK. On his phone, he texted, "Okay, coming out. Don't shoot." He didn't wait for a reply, but instead slowly pushed the doors, keeping his body as close to the ground as possible. If they were seen now and the alarm was raised, they'd start taking fire. death by bullet or death by explosion. It didn't matter. Once he got Belinda onto level ground, he started his crawl-drag routine again, aiming toward a cluster of trees ahead. 10 feet to go. He rasped, "Belinda, help me. Crawl." She muttered something incomprehensible, but his words must have registered. She started clawing at the ground and churning her legs. 5 feet. Jack's cell phone beeped. He glanced at the screen. Time's up. He heard a whoosh. The air around him flashed orange. And then, heat. A voice shouting in German filtered into Jack's subconscious. He forced open his eyes but remained still. His brain was playing catch-up, assembling imagery and sound into something tangible, familiar. Cabin, he thought. Explosion. The air was thick with the smell of burning wood and the sound of crackling flames. A few inches from his eyes, a leaf was smoldering, its edges glowing orange. His scalp felt hot. He heard a rustling. It was feet crunching through undergrowth, he decided. Don't move. There were no friendlies out here, he reminded himself. Only hostiles. Jack squeezed his right hand and felt the solidity of the HK's grip. The crunching came closer, somewhere to his front and left. He tracked his eyes back along the ground until an arm came into view. This he followed back to a head of short brown hair. Belinda.
Etwas?
A voice called in the distance.
Anything. Nein.
The reply came from very close. Very slowly, Jack lifted his head, rotated it, and pressed it back to the earth. 8 feet away, a man illuminated by the flames crept from behind a tree trunk. His eyes scanned the ground ahead and to his sides. He held a compact assault rifle, similar to the FAMAS models carried by the men at Kultfabrik, Jack guessed, across his chest. Belinda groaned, then stirred, rustling the leaves. The man froze, then slowly pivoted toward the sound. Slowly, Jack rolled right, sweeping his gun arm under his body as he went until it was fully extended along the ground. He lifted the HK slightly and laid the front sight on the man's chest. He fired. The man went down. Jack rolled back onto his belly, then wriggled sideways until he was facing the ruined cabin. All that remained of the structure was a burning heap of debris sitting atop the foundation turned crater. The heat from the flames stung Jack's face. He suspected the propane's heavier-than-air density had worked in their favor. Most of the gas had settled on the first floor and in the basement, and Jack's opening of the windows had dissipated some of the former. Sitting as far below ground as it did, the basement had funneled most of the blast vertically. In fact, the ground nearest the house was almost pristine. Farther out, the terrain was littered with smoldering chunks of wood and wreckage, some as big as Jack himself. Lucky or good? Which was better? In this case, luck. He reached out, found Belinda's hand, and pinched and twisted the soft skin of her wrist. She jerked her hand away. Jack whispered,
"Belinda, if you can hear me, don't speak. Flex your fingers."
She did so.
"We're in trouble. Can you crawl?"
Belinda lifted her head and looked at him. The hair encircling her face was singed and crinkled.
"I can crawl," she whispered.
Jack took it slowly until he'd put a screen of tree trunks between them and the cabin. He rose to his knees and helped Belinda do the same and held her steady as she got her bearings. She looked back at the cabin. Her eyes glittered in the flames.
"Bastards," she whispered. "Rotten bastards."
"Payback comes later," Jack replied. "Right now we need to keep moving." Jürgen Rostock had declared war on them. Jack wanted to be far away by the time Rostock realized. He'd missed his targets yet again. Chapter 26. Zurich, Switzerland. As far as Jack was concerned, Munich was a closed door to them, and he wanted to spend as little time in Zurich as possible. They were prey, and their only advantage right now was mobility. Jack wanted to accomplish two things in Zurich. One, investigate the villa to which Ephraim had tracked Eric Schrader, and two, do some digging into Alexander Bossard, the owner of the plane that had rescued Stefan Müller from the airstrip in Vermont. For Jack, the question wasn't so much whether Bossard was connected to Jürgen Rostock, but how exactly. It was an hour before dawn, and ahead Jack could see the glow of Zurich's skyline on the horizon. They'd made the 200-mile trip from Munich in just over 2 hours. Jack had been on the Autobahn before, but never at night. He'd found the experience at once exhilarating and exhausting. After escaping the cabin and reaching the car, Jack had driven south to Munich, where he'd picked up Ephraim and their luggage. They'd then gotten on the Autobahn and headed west at top speed. Belinda, still suffering the effects of either the propane exposure or the shock of the incident, or both, lay curled up in the Citroën's back seat, a sweater tucked under her chin. Here and there, singed hairs jutted from her head like bent electrical wires. Ephraim was also asleep, his head resting against the passenger seat window. Jack hit a bump in the road, and Ephraim bolted forward, hands reaching for the dashboard. He blinked rapidly and looked around. Jack said, "You're okay. We're a few miles outside Zurich."
"Thank Cronkite," Ephraim said.
"Pardon?"
"Something I picked up from my mother. She's an atheist.
Walter Cronkite is as close to a god as she allowed in her life." "Were you dreaming about Müller?" Jack asked. Ephraim nodded.
"I was still in the SUV. It was on its side, and Müller was pouring gas through the sunroof."
Jack decided to use this as a segue. "We need to talk about what happened at Kultfabrik."
"About what?"
"I told you not to get out of the car. You got out of the car."
"So?" "I was trying to help, Jack. I wasn't about to let Müller.
What you did was hand yourself to him, and now we'll be damned lucky if the Munich police aren't hunting for us. If Müller had gotten you alone, but he didn't, did he? Things turned out okay."
Jack felt a knot of anger forming in his belly. "That's not the point, damn it. The point is, I had a reason for telling you to stay put."
"Which was?"
"One, to keep you out of the line of fire. Two, to have you as another pair of eyes. Three, as backup in case I needed someone followed."
Ephraim took a few seconds to answer.
"I hadn't thought about two and three."
The irony of this conversation wasn't lost on Jack. Change the words and the setting, and it could have easily been an exchange between him and John Clark or Jerry Hendley. Plenty of times Jack had acted on well-intentioned impulse, but in tight spots, good intentions didn't make either you or those around you bulletproof. The difference between things turning out okay and catastrophe often sat balanced on a knife's edge, waiting for that Guatemalan butterfly to flap its wings. Now, suddenly seeing himself from the outside looking in, Jack felt his stomach churn. My God, how many times had he come close to getting someone killed without realizing it, or almost blown an operation because he refused to pause, take a breath, and listen to someone else? Ephraim was young and eager, and perhaps only now was he realizing the deadly seriousness of what they were doing. Jack had no such excuses. He'd had years to outgrow his impulsivity, and yet he hadn't. Why? In fact, wasn't this one of those times he should be pausing to reassess the situation? They were flying by the seat of their pants, and Jack was at the stick. Was it time to make a call to Clark or Hendley, he wondered, and tell them what exactly? The truth was, beyond being able to make a marginal case that Stefan Müller was a murderer, he had nothing but hunches and an ever-growing list of questions. And now it was too late to call a halt. He had two lives in his hands. If he went home, Ephraim and Belinda were as good as dead. The only help Jerry Hendley would and could offer was an escort to get them back to the United States safely and a few well-placed phone calls to a higher authority. And then what, he thought. Hope someone else solved the problem? No. They were in the thick of it now. They had to keep moving and keep digging until Jack found a way to end it. He realized he was gripping the Citroen's wheel so tightly his hands were shaking. He was one of those idiot swimmers who paddle into the ocean only to realize they've gotten caught in a riptide. Jack said, "Listen, Ephraim, a lot of this is my fault. You shouldn't be here. Back in Alexandria, I should have said no. It wouldn't have stopped me." "Maybe not." Jack shrugged. "Either way, you need to hear what I'm saying. These people have tried to kill both of us, and they're going to keep trying. We either stop now and call for help, or we get our shit together and do this right." "I vote for that, the shit together option." "Fine, but that means listening to me and doing what I tell you. If there's time to explain, I will. Otherwise, just do it." Ephraim nodded, then grinned. "So, when you say jump, I ask how high?" "When I say jump, you do it, then ask when you can come back down." From the back seat, Belinda called groggily,
"What stinks in here?"
"Your hair," Ephraim replied.
"Right. And who are you again?"
"Ephraim." He jerked a thumb toward Jack.
"I'm with him."
Jack drove around the northern outskirts of